call to order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is the 18th of May. We've got a number of items on the agenda today, and so I'm going to explain to everybody my intent with this schedule, because we're going to jump around a little bit, and we don't have all members here yet, and we have two work sessions scheduled, so we will not do those work sessions until we get some more members here. And at that point, we will do the work sessions on HJM 19 and House Bill 3329. We're going to start with House Bill 3223. And then as representatives come in for 3068 and 3282, legislators that want to testify on those, I'll open up those hearings. So we're probably going to have a bunch of hearings open at the same time. And then as we can, we will close them up and put them away. But it's going to be a little bit of jumping around today because of other obligations of members of the committee. So we're going to start out with opening up a public hearing on Representative Johnson's bill, since he's arrived on the scene, House Bill 3068. Representative, no time to collect yourself. Tell us a little bit about what the bill is, Beth, and then we'll turn it over to the representative.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 3068A has a no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact, and it would direct the Department of Environmental Quality to form a work group to study and develop recommendations for reducing wood stove smoke.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Those of you that there are here today, must be in some long weekends, I guess. State Representative Mark Johnson from Hood River, House District 52. Thanks for hearing the bill. This is about wood stoves and air particulate matter that can come from them. As it's, I'm sure, no secret to you all, wood stoves do put smoke into the air, and some of that smoke does have particulate matter in it, and there can be health issues, and I'm sure there'll be some folks behind us that will talk about that. I know we had that testimony in our House committee. But the other issue that I think people don't take into consideration is potential economic impacts. Due to federal EPA clean air guidelines, there are thresholds that they have in place in certain areas where beyond which, if your threshold exceeds a certain level, it can forestall the ability to increase economic development, industrial siting, and so forth. And we do have a couple of areas in the state of Oregon that are getting pretty close to that. There's some areas I know out in Washington County which are problematic. I think that in the Klamath Falls areas as well. And sometimes it's just simply geography that creates these issues. But be that as it may, rather than just let the agencies control this, the idea was here to put together a work group that would have a chance to, through DEQ, to have a chance to really study this issue. And it's interesting that there were three identical placeholder bills that were dropped in our House Environment Committee, and my bill ended up being the vehicle going forward, which is great. But so I got some language into the bill that was of particular interest to me as somebody who's from rural Oregon, where I have a wood stove in my house. I'm down to one. I used to have two, but my wife got tired of all the mess in the living room, so we have a propane fireplace there that I can press the remote in time. She says, make a fire, honey, and it works really well. It's clean. But yet, you know, living with wood stoves and using those as a heat source is a real it's a definite need and a great part of rural Oregon, especially eastern Oregon. So the last thing that I wanted to have was a study group by the agency that would have folks from, let's just say, and I'm not gonna want to offend anybody here, Senator Dembro, but folks from North Portland telling folks from Klamath Falls how they should live. So it's important to know that working with DEQ and so forth, especially Palmer, on the language that we have in here, that we will have stakeholders represented on this task force who are from those geographical areas that could potentially be impacted. I wanted to make sure we've got folks from Burns and Baker and the outlying areas providing input on what could be a rational, reasonable way forward, and how could the state help not take away wood stoves or take away the ability, but what sort of incentives could we provide, what sort of state assistance could we provide for in those situations where somebody wants to transition into a cleaner sort of heat source, could be natural gas, could be propane. We actually have language in here about high-quality wood pellets and so forth, too. There's a lot of viable alternatives out there that could potentially be less polluting and so forth. So I think in a nutshell, that's basically it. DEQ will report back to the legislature by September of 16 with any recommendations on any type of legislation might be required or financial incentives. I would say there were two no's in our committee, but I would say that both of those folks were more, I think, protesting the existence of the EPA standards that kind of drive this kind of discussion at the state level, because there are federal standards that govern what we do and so forth, and there's just not a way to get around that. So that's what it is, pretty similar or simple little bill. So love to have your consideration and support.
Great. Thank you for bringing it to us. Yeah. Any questions of the representative? Yes. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, I was just going to say that the original form of this bill came from this committee. as usual, the Senate led. Then
you had that coming down. I mean,
I know it.
You had to dig at North Portland.
He did, I know.
Yeah, and I will say I do agree with you about North Portland. We're at Northeast Portland, that would be different. But
well, no. We tend to lump everybody in the same soup, you know that.
Yeah. No, I think this bill really addresses a real issue.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the real challenges of the group will be trying to come up with funding mechanisms to make it easier for people to do those conversions, because they can be really expensive, and
exactly.
Many people who are relying on wood stoves exclusively are pretty low income.
Mm-hmm.
And but at the same time, we were hoping that DEQ could take a look at how this might dovetail with our efforts to build our biomass industry and the wood pellets and all of that. So, I'm really pleased that the House moved forward with this and that we get to take it home.
As you wish.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. I am a wood stove user. So I have a question for you. You said that you can convert to propane and pellets and things like that, but what do you say to the consumer that has a wood stove that can get his firewood for free, goes out into the forest and picks up and cleans up the forest and burns that wood? How do you justify his expense?
His expense? I'm sorry.
Yeah, to convert to a pellet stove, which the pellets are expensive, or to propane, which is expensive.
Senator, I don't think there'd be any compelling language. I don't think there's any compelling language in this bill to say that if we're working towards taking those folks away from those resources that work well for them. You know, I would envision something that totally would be elective on the part of those folks that are happy with what's working for them. That's fine, but I know that there are those folks in certain communities. Again, in certain communities, I think it's much more of an issue if, in fact, you know that you live in an area that perhaps like Hillsborough, where I think they're very close to the particulate matter threshold, and the community at large could have a vested interest in being able to lure in that next industry that's going to provide 500, 600, or 700 jobs, but it could be simply the amount of stuff floating around in the air that prevents that from happening. So my intent is certainly not to preclude anybody from using wood as I do. I clean up my own forest floor, and I do that exact thing what you're talking about. It's a free source of heat for me. So this is not intended at all to move people away from that. It's simply to provide an option to address the issue as it does exist in some parts of Oregon.
Follow up. Well, let me ask you a question then. In 1991, when we took out the old wood stoves, if you sell a new house, it has an old wood stove, it has to be thrown away. Its value is absolutely worthless.
Mm-hmm.
Other than for scrap metal. When we went to those nowhere stoves, they were supposed to be the premier stove, and we're getting better and better.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you say to those folks that want to upgrade to the newer technological type stove but still want to burn wood? Because my fear is that when a work group is formed, they're going to have to come out with something. They don't just sit around and play tiddlywinks, so they're going to come up with some recommendations which are going to put further restraints on people that use wood. And we talk about biomass, et cetera, and we want to go to that. But those homeowners don't have the resources that large industries do. So how do you justify if we go to the newest type of wood stove to get by, but yet we're going to get some ruling that says that we can't do this because we live in Hillsborough or wherever it might be?
I would say that, you know, if somebody has a wood stove that they purchased since 91, it probably has some sort of catalytic converter on it that I do on my stove. I think I probably bought mine about 92 or 93. That should be fine. I think what we're talking about primarily is some of those pre-90, some of the old, I mean, you know, they're very simple. They burn really well, but they put out a lot of heat, but they also put a lot of particulate matter. So it's those folks where you have situations where we just provide some options for folks who might want to transition out away from that. So I can't answer what kind of findings the commission would come back with or report would come back with. But, again, it's not intended to say thou shalt not. It just says, you know, there could be a potential health risk in your neighborhood. There could be also potential risk to industrial development, and that's why we want to at least have some options out there and see how the state could be a partner with helping those folks to transition who choose to do so.
Follow up. Will this work group also look at the industry to see what their improvements are and see what they've done to remove material?
Which industry are you referring to, Senator?
The wood stove industry.
Regarding their upgrades?
Yeah, will this work group look at the wood stove industry and see what kind of modifications they've made to upgrade wood stoves to meet DEQ requirements?
Senator, I would hope that it'd be a really far-ranging report back on what's available, what technology has done, and what technology may be doing going forward, just to, you know, again, if technology could be the driver of reducing the cost of some of these too, just like they have been on solar panels, who knows? But I'm just saying more volume of these could lead to lower costs on manufacturing and so forth. So I would hope so.
Thank you. Senator Denbrough.
No, actually, Representative Johnson said what I was going to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, I'm sorry I was in another committee, so I didn't get to hear the beginning of your testimony. But what I know of this bill, I know this has been a situation that in my district we've been working and attempting to give individuals, especially those who are on low income, the opportunity to be able to participate. Clearly, Oak Ridge is one of the areas that's an extreme problem during the winter months. And I know that we have looked at how about either credits against wood stoves or other type of means of trying to get these updates, and it's very unfortunate that many of the individuals in these more economic depressed rural areas just have not had the ability to modernize, and they do in fact have stoves that are definitely pre-catalytic converters.
Exactly. Thank you, Senator.
Any other questions for the representative?
Okay. Thank you.
You bet. All right, as I said before, we're going to jump around a little bit. We're going to leave that public hearing open so we can come back to it. But now we have Representative Bueller here, so we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3282. Beth, if you'd tell us a little bit about what the bill is about, and then we'll move to the representative.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 3282 would permit cities to undergo a periodic review for the limited purpose of completing changes to proposed amendments to comprehensive plan and land use regulations required on remand after review by LCDC.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair Edwards, esteemed members of the committee. For the record, my name is Representative Newt Bueller. I represent House District 54, which is most of the city of Bend, and here to speak in support of House Bill 3282, which I'm happy to report already has bicameral and bipartisan support. Basically, what this will do is provide a more workable and simple ability for a city to go through and complete an urban growth boundary update. In the bottom line is it allows one to sequentially go through that approval process. For example, to make the case of actually why you need more land before going into the details of how and what you're going to do with it. And this came to light as Ben looks at its remand process and difficulties it's had in the past. And we find other cities find this approach attractive. We appreciate LCDC's input with regards to this legislation and making it as workable as possible for the agency. And I think it will create a narrowly focused work program for each city going through this remand type process. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Representative Bueller, anything that can expedite LCDC in getting their projects done is a good bill.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments?
And they've been very helpful in going through this process and making this legislation workable for them also. So.
Great. Yeah. Senator
Brzezinski. Yeah. Representative Mueller, looking at it real quickly, I don't see dates as to how frequent this could be done or would be done. Was that discussed, or is that to be done by rule?
My impression is that's to be done by rule, but I wouldn't think it would be a frequent thing because that's going to be time-consuming.
Exactly.
So I think it's more at the major stages in the work program. Again, really, that example I use to make the case why, you know, pretty broadly before going on to the details of the plan. So,
thank you.
Other questions, comments? Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
We will we'll leave that public hearing open, and then because we have, I believe, a member or two may have to leave early today, so we're going to jump in over to our work sessions. So we're going to open up now a work session on House or HJM 19.
Mr. Chair, I move HJM 19 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Senator Olson has moved HJM 19 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Are there any questions, any comments, concerns, discussion? Okay, seeing none. Are there any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. We'll need a, let's see.
What's it?
Senator Canope.
Oh, that was Canope.
That one was from Canope. So, yeah, we'll assign that one to Senator Canope. We'll close the work session on HJM 19. We'll open up a work session on HB 3329.
Mr. Chair, I move HB 3329 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves HB 3329 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? Questions? Okay. Are there any objections to the motion? Seeing none, the motion carries. This one was Senator Whitsitt's, so we'll assign that to Senator Whitsitt. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 3329. And we will move back to our public hearings. Oh, and I forgot to mention that the hearing on House Bill 3217, that's the artificial beaver dam bill. We will be doing that one last. So we'll go through the other bills prior, get through all the testimony, and then we'll move to 3217. So with that, let's go back and wrap up on House Bill 3068. So I think we have the department TEQ here to testify on the wood stove smoke bill.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. I have here with me today Rachel Sakata. She's an air quality planner at the department. We're here to talk about House Bill 3068. We are definitely supportive of the bill and have worked very closely with the sponsor, Representative Johnson, and others on this particular bill and the issue at large, and look forward to your consideration of it. And Rachel's going to provide some more background about the bill, and hopefully we can take any questions you have and answer them. Thanks.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. As Palmer mentioned, my name is Rachel Sakata, and I'm an air quality planner with the Department of Environmental Quality. Now, I'm here today to provide information for House Bill 3068. And this bill directs the Department of Environmental Quality to study and develop recommendations for legislation to reduce wood stove smoke and to report back to the legislature by September of 2016. This bill gives us the opportunity to find new ways to address wood smoke and prevent communities from being burdened by a non-attainment designation. As Palmer mentioned, DEQ supports this bill. So wood stove smoke is a problem in communities all across Oregon as they struggle to meet federal health standards for fine particulate, or PM 2.5. Now, PM 2.5 is particulate matter 2.5 microns and smaller, and just to give you an idea of how small that is, a strand of hair is 70 microns in diameter, so it's pretty tiny. Particulate matter in wood stove smoke can be easily inhaled and reach the deepest part of our lungs, and is known to cause or contribute to respiratory disease, asthma, heart attacks, and premature death. and wood smoke also contains toxic organic compounds known to cause cancer. So wintertime residential wood smoke, wood burning is the most significant source of fine particulate matter in most communities in or on the verge of non-attainment. Communities declared non-attainment face serious public health and economic burdens. A non-attainment status imposed by the Federal Clean Air Act means not only is the air unhealthy, but it creates an economic burden on a community through imposing stricter requirements on new and existing industries and can be a deterrent to attracting new business. Now, we currently have two communities, as Senator Przanski mentioned. Oak Ridge is one of them. Klamath Falls is another one that are currently designated as non-attainment for PM 2.5. Much of the PM 2.5 problem in these communities is due to wood smoke. However, we have good news in the fact that Klamath Falls recently came into compliance with the standard, thanks to the hard work and dedication of the local government, businesses, and citizens to implement clean air strategies, specifically targeting wood smoke reductions. And there are also other communities throughout the state dealing with PM 2.5 issues, as Representative Johnson mentioned. Other communities such as Lakeview and Prineville also exceed the standard but have not yet been classified by the EPA as non-attainment areas. There are also half a dozen communities that are at risk from elevated fine particulate levels, such as Hillsboro and Burns. Uncertified wood stoves are certainly a huge part of the problem, as they emit up to 70% more particulate air pollution and 25% more benzene than newer certified stoves that meet federal emission standards. Smoke from these uncertified wood stoves can also affect indoor air quality and create poor air quality both inside and directly outside the home. DEQ currently estimates that there are about 150,000 homes with an uncertified wood stove. So we've worked with all of the communities to help provide technical assistance and help put prevention plans in place. However, to really help these communities address wood stove smoke, we need more long-term strategies and new ideas to help them avoid non-attainment. DEQ has had success with wood stove changeouts and working with communities to institute wood stove burning prohibitions during poor air quality days. However, in the case of wood stove changeouts, that funding can be sporadic and limited. So House Bill 3068 creates a new opportunity to re-examine how the state works with communities and stakeholders to finance improvements in cleaner air. We will be able to explore new ideas about sustained resources for stove replacement and new strategies to reduce smoke in risk communities during the stagnation events that threaten health and non-attainment. If we are able to directly address wood stove smoke in PM 2.5 affected communities, we can help solve and prevent non-attainment problems. So in order to identify these strategies and ideas and conduct the study and develop recommendations that affect all Oregonians, House Bill 3068 directs DEQ to form a work group. It will help us brainstorm ways to address wood smoke in both rural and urban communities where there may be different clean burning home heating challenges in these areas. So this can include the challenges of having no natural gas lines, for example, in areas like Oak Ridge and in Lakeview, to very dense urban neighborhoods like the Portland metro area that are adversely affected by wood stove smoke. So this bill also directs DEQ to consult with other agencies such as the Department of Energy, the Department of Forestry, the Public Utilities Commission, Oregon Business Development Department, and other stakeholders to help us research and brainstorm ideas. House Bill 3068 also directs the DEQ to develop recommendations for strategies to encourage the use of biomass. So this includes opportunities to have a conversation with other agencies and stakeholders about clean biomass, including the possibility of increasing production and use of high-quality wood pellet fuel in Oregon and the role of subsidies to encourage pellet use in these households. So DEQ looks forward to the opportunity of collaborating with other agencies and stakeholders, including the Hearth Products Association, to identify strategies to reduce wood stove smoke. Overall, DEQ is committed to creating a healthier environment for all Oregonians by reducing the level of fine particulate and air toxics. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Great, thank you. Questions for the department? Yeah, Senator Olson.
Thank you very much. How do you determine how many wood stoves there are?
So
You gave a number, didn't you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, yes. We estimate that there are about 150,000 homes with an uncertified wood stove. This is based on surveys that we do throughout the state. So, for example, we did a recent survey for the state, and that's how we were able to come up with these numbers.
Follow-up?
Yeah. How many fireplaces are there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I'd have to get back to you on that. I don't have specific numbers on how many fireplaces there are.
Follow-up?
Yeah.
Follow-up. Efficiency between a fireplace and a wood stove.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, fireplace emissions are probably at least 10 to 15 times higher than a certified wood stove. They're really inefficient. They don't put out any heat, basically all the heat goes right back out the chimney.
Follow-up. The point I'm trying to make is in some of these areas that are having difficulty attaining, do you know the percentage of wood stoves to fireplaces?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, yes, we can get you more specific numbers. We'd have to look at them per community, but we have done surveys, for example, in Klamath Falls and in Lakeview to sort of get an estimate of how many wood stoves are versus fireplaces.
Could you follow up? Could you get that information to the committee and put it on OLIS so everyone can see that?
Certainly.
Because I think the wood stoves are definitely, they're a problem. I actually put mine in my house in 1987, and I have a catalytic converter on it, or catalytic burner. But I'm just curious to find out the impact of fireplaces and how many fireplaces are used in proportion to the number of wood stoves. Because that would, your air quality is going to be intermixed with a portion of fireplaces and a portion of wood stoves, and if you reduce the portion of wood stoves and not do anything for the fireplaces, we're still going to have dirty air. Thank you.
Senator Devereaux, you. Okay. Yeah, I know you wanted to ask a question.
No, I was just responding to Senator Olson. I mean, I think the goal is to do both. The fireplaces where people are using fireplaces as a primary heat source for their homes, that's a big problem. And that, I assume, will be addressed in this.
Yeah, the I don't see that the legislation. It's to reduce wood stove smoke. So it doesn't say wood smoke. It says wood stove smoke. So I would hope that fireplaces are taken into consideration as well. I don't know.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, if I might respond to Senator Dembrough's question, I think that's probably right. I mean, many of the strategies that will be looked at, I would imagine by the work group, would have applicability for fireplaces. So, for instance, if we're trying to help low-income folks get cleaner, drier fuel, could include helping people get the resources they need, the fuel they need for a fireplace. Obviously, the two pieces of equipment are not exactly the same, but I think a lot of the strategies could have overlap. And if we're in a place where we can encourage and it makes sense for the folks in those homes to switch over to natural gas, then that might also be an instance where we can help folks with fireplaces as much as those with wood stoves. Mm-hmm.
Is the certification that you referred to earlier, is that a particulate emission certification, or is that a heat efficiency certification, and to what degree are the two correlated?
So, Mr. Chair, the certification refers to emissions for PM2.5.
Okay.
So stoves are required to meet a certain emissions requirement. However, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency did recently pass rules within this past year that also require stoves to be tested to look at efficiency, because they recognize that efficiency and emissions can be closely related. So a lot of the stoves now will have an efficiency rating also to help the consumer make good choices.
Great. Other questions?
Yeah, I have I was just thinking about this when you were talking about efficiency of wood stoves. How much have we progressed since 1991 on efficiencies?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, we've progressed quite a bit. The manufacturers have done quite a bit to improve the efficiency and overall emissions of stoves. As I mentioned, EPA did recently. So EPA last came out with standards in roughly 1991. Oregon was actually the first state to require emissions certification in the late 1980s. Then EPA basically copied our rules and passed national standards in the early 90s. They finally got around to updating their standards within this past year. So they've really brought the levels down quite a bit from roughly 7.5 grams per hour down to 4.5 grams per hour now.
What was that number?
7.5 grams per hour for stoves down to 4.5 grams
down
per
to
hour.
4.5.
And then in another 5 years, they have to lower it down to 2.0 grams per hour. So they're really making huge improvements for stoves and other wood-burning devices.
Other questions for the department? Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that has not signed up who would like to testify on House Bill 3068? I don't see anybody jumping up, so we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3068. And we still have the public hearing open on House Bill 3282. Which was the UGB bill that Representative Bueller brought to us. And so we're going to proceed through that hearing. Eric Kanzler, you're up next. And Eric is the only person that signed up. So if there's anybody else that would like to testify on that bill, get ready. So go ahead.
All right, Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, Eric Kanzler representing the City of Bend. House Bill 3282 is about UGB expansions, as Representative Bueller illustrated. More specifically, it's a bill that helps to ensure focused and effective resolution of UGB remands, or UGBs that have been under dispute for some reason and have been sent back to the city. The bill is without any known opposition. It hasn't had, thus far, a single dissenting vote. And DLCD and Thousand Friends, each of which were very helpful in arriving at such a broadly supported outcome, have indicated that they're perfectly fine with the bill. The way that we look at this, the City of Bend, that is this is really not much more than a technical bill in that it takes something that's most likely already allowed under law and it makes it explicit in statute. What it does is clarify that a city can use a process called periodic review to process the unresolved elements of a UGB remand. Current practice often requires cities to resubmit the entire proposal or at least large portions of it, even if only several small elements remain to be addressed, and that can take pretty significant time and come at a pretty significant expense. Bend is planning to make the transition to periodic review to address its remand, and as far as we know, we'd be the first city that would ever have done that, which would be kind of a, at least if you're a land use nerd like myself, would be a pretty interesting step, and I think a very effective step. House Bill 3282, by making this option explicit, helps us to give us confidence in making this switch and knowing that it is perfectly legal and unquestionably so. I've talked with other cities that have had lengthy UGB expansion processes, such as Woodburn, Scappoose, and Springfield, each of which is supportive of options like this to clarify the usability of periodic review. I've talked with a number of counties as well who are partners with cities in UGB amendment applications. Again, as Representative Bueller mentioned, the bill enjoys a bipartisan, bicameral sponsorship. We're very proud of the effort that's gone into the bill thus far and the support that it's received. And we ask for your support in moving the bill to the Senate floor and hopefully and ultimately for passing it into law. Thank you. I'm happy to take any questions.
All right. questions for Eric? Okay, I don't see any questions. And Senator Przonski isn't here at the moment, but so we'll he's just outside. Okay. Yeah, why don't you drag him in here? We're going to close the thank you. That's it for you.
Okay.
Is there anybody else that wants to testify on this bill, 3282, going once, going twice? A land use bill, and we have two people testify.
Remarkable.
It must not do much. Okay, we're going to close
the gavel out. Then everyone's
sorry.
Right.
I couldn't help myself. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3282. Committee members, you're fine with that? I'm getting positive feedback. Everybody's okay. So we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 3282.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3282 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 3282 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, are there any objections? Okay, the motion carries. And I imagine that Senator Canope may want to carry this bill, so we'll check in with him. We'll assume that he's going to carry. If he doesn't want to carry, then Senator Olson will carry. We'll close the public. Close the work session on House Bill 3282, and we're going to move forward to the next item on the agenda, which is a work session. We're going to open up a work session on House Bill 3223. Excuse me. We're opening up a public hearing on, not a work session, a public hearing on House Bill 3223.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 3223 would restrict expedited land divisions to include only land that is zoned for residential uses and is within an urban growth boundary.
All right. We only have one person signed up for this bill, but
what a guy.
Depending on what he says, we may fill this hearing room. You never know.
That's tomorrow's hearing, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here on behalf of wood stoves and fake beaver dams. House Bill 3223 is a fine bit of public policy. I have a 45-minute PowerPoint I was prepared to show you, but in light of the hour, I will not do that. Expedited land divisions have been in the books since the 90s. There actually were a creation that I and Bob Stacey, who used to be the planning director for the City of Portland before he went off to be governor's staff, 1,000 Friends of Oregon, and currently a metro councillor. And the logic behind them is, as you've heard in other contexts, sometimes land use proceedings can be pretty long and tortuous. And if the things we want to see happen go through long and tortuous processes, chances are they're not going to happen. So the notion behind expedited land divisions was to say, for that context, high-density housing, which is defined in the statute as 80% or more of the base density, so 9 units in a 10-unit zone, for example, ought to get a faster process, hence the name. And it's a much shorter process at the local level, much limited appeals, and so on. I still think is an excellent idea. And the reason we brought this bill forward this session was to do several things. One, simply because so much time had passed since 95 when it was put in the statutes, it had sort of eroded in terms of its utility at the city level and in the developer community, frankly. So we wanted to remind people that it was out there as a good tool. We also wanted to make it clear that it applied not just to subdivisions, but subdivisions and partitions. We also wanted to have the cities some responsibility to tell people that this was available to them as a planning tool. This amendment, the bill in front of you as amended, says that upon receipt of an application, the cities have to tell an applicant if they qualify, and then give them the choice to process in this fashion or not. And the other, and I think particularly in light of other conversations and other committees this session on affordable housing, we added an additional criteria for an expedited land division. In addition to the density, which remains the same, 80% or more of the base density, we added housing to be sold to or rented to people making less than 120% of median income, or affordable housing. Again, that's a societal goal that people say we want, and let's give it a fast path and make sure we get more of it. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to take any questions. I do think it is a good bill, all kidding aside. I think it'll help both increase our urban density and the type of development that our planning system seems to be oriented around, as well as make affordable housing a little bit easier by removing some of those barriers. And I'll be glad to take questions.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Chandler?
Of course, thank you, Mr. Chandler, for that. You talked about affordable housing. So if they want to go through the expedited process, say they're doing a 20-lot subdivision, and they want to go through the expedited process to speed it up, how many houses do they have to put in there in the affordable category? And by affordable, what's the definition of affordable?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, the definition, there isn't one to speak of. It says, will be sold or rented to households with incomes below 120% of the median family income for the county in which the project is built. So that'd be up to the county-by-county analysis of what would fit in there. And as far as number of units, it doesn't actually say one way or the other. I would think if you're doing a 20-unit subdivision, most of them, they would have to be available for that purpose to get the expedited treatment in your hypothetical.
And once again, in the hypothetical, if in this 20-lot subdivision they were building $500,000 houses, 120% of the median, most of those people would not meet their criteria to move into a house of that quality, would they?
Unless, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I can't think of a county in Oregon where that would fit.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions of Mr. Chandler? Don't see any, so thank you. Oh, I do have one additional question, sorry. because nobody else has signed up to testify, and so I don't think anybody's going to come forth. You'd characterize this as a consensus bill, and I think you may have already said that. But I
don't think I used that term, but yes, there wasn't much testimony on the House side either. As I say, this has been on the books for literally 20-plus years, and the cities aren't wild about it, but I don't know if they certainly didn't oppose. Mm-hmm. And I think they weren't wild about it in 95 either. Mm-hmm. But I think there was no opposition from the department, no opposition from the cities, no opposition from any of the usual suspects. Okay. Kind of hurt my feelings, as a matter of fact.
Mr. Chair, I noticed, you know, on the floor vote, there was no opposition, and those who didn't show up, but that was quite bipartisan.
Right? Mr. Chair, Senator Ambrose, yes. This was not the bill that came out in haiku. That was 3222, but it could have been.
Okay.
The floor speech, that is.
Anything else? Anybody? Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We are going to... we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3223. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3223, and we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3217, the Beaver Dam Bill.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 3217 would direct the Department of State Lands to establish by rule a pilot program for voluntary stream restoration and beaver recovery through the construction of artificial beaver dams located in Malheur Lake Drainage Basin.
So if we could bring forward Rocky Dahlem, Alan Hickabotham, and Gordon Grant to start first panel, and then we'll just start going through folks here, so.
Yes, we'll go ahead and start. Let Gordon go. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, I'm Rocky Dahlem. I'm here on behalf of Sylvie's Valley Ranch, and I direct the committee to Martha Pagel's testimony that's on OLIS, but in an effort to kind of frame the context of this bill and where we are at, I will paraphrase some of the important pieces of that. Sylvie's Valley Ranch has successfully undertaken efforts to restore streams and beaver habitat in an effort to address severe erosion and incised streams, something that the other members of the panel will address in probably better technical terms than I would. This bill is really aimed at creating a pilot program to continue that work and have an incentive for other private landowners to be able to address this problem of erosion and site streams and bring beaver habitat back to parts of eastern Oregon where it used to be. So what 3217 does, it recognizes these issues of erosion, promotes voluntary stream restoration and efforts by private landowners, and as I said, it's a pilot program narrowly tailored to the Malheur Basin. And it waives fish passage requirements only for places where fish passage is currently not happening because of the incised streams. Why is the bill needed? Well, I think that some of the people here will talk about the history lesson of what's happened in eastern Oregon, but as the beaver population eradicated well over 100 years ago and the effects of water moving throughout eastern Oregon, we've seen a degradation of beaver habitat, continuing erosion in streams. Some streams have been cut down as far as 10 feet or more from the original or natural surface level. And as this erosion continues in eastern Oregon, then you see the arrival of other species other than where the natural beaver habitat is. The ones that come to mind most prevalently are sagebrush and juniper and other upland vegetation. This loss of riparian vegetation, including aspens and cottonwood, inhibits the natural return of the beaver because of the lack of their natural habitat and food supply. Well, I'll talk now about how the bill aims to address the problem. This bill directs the Department of State Lands to set up a simplified permitting process that would authorize voluntary stream restoration by private landowners to construct these artificial beaver dams, or ABDs. Again, it would be a pilot program in the Malheur Basin of eastern Oregon, limited to small streams, and this is an important part, I think, to make, as you'll hear more testimony today, streams that are currently eroded to the extent that they do not support, as of now, native migratory fish or beavers. This simplified process would be implemented by DSL and would include details on how the ABDs would be constructed, maintained, and monitored. The bill would also include a waiver from separate ODF&W fish passage requirements for qualifying streams that do not currently support native migratory fish, but will include provisions for providing for future fish passage to the extent practicable once the beaver dams are constructed and once stream conditions are restored to that original purpose. A couple things that this bill does not do. It does not create an outright exemption for permitting process, but instead it directs DSL to establish rule provisions for either general authorization or a general permitting process. The goal of this bill is to incentivize other private landowners besides Sylvie's Valley Ranch to undertake this type of work. The other piece that the bill does not do, it does not authorize any new storage or use of water that would otherwise require a water right. And I'll transition a bit into some of the changes from the original bill and work that we did in the House with some of the folks who are going to testify here today to address some concerns. One, we clarified that this bill, or legislative findings that this bill, would be a pilot program to determine whether construction of ABDs will actually help restore environmental and economic health. I think there's one problem that everyone agrees we need to address, the method of how we can address that as opposed to maintaining the static state in eastern Oregon is what we're going for. We've added a definition for the term low profile of ABDs in relation to the construction of these dams in working with some of the other stakeholders on the bill. We've revised the definition of qualified stream to limit the pilot project so streams that are currently incised or eroded to the point that they are not inhabited by native migratory fish or beavers before commencement of this type of restoration work. We also clarified that the program is designed to promote natural reintroduction of beavers once that suitable habitat is restored. Requirements for specific information to be provided by participating landowners to the various departments, direction to the implementation of rules to be adopted by DSL, and then again, one of the major changes we made to the legislation in the House was to clarify that nothing in this bill is intended to or shall be construed to modify any requirements for water rights. So in conclusion, I'll let the other folks here on the panel talk about more of the technical aspects and the reason why this is important, but that's in general what the bill is trying to do, and wanted to give some context about the work that we've done with other stakeholders to get to a point where we can start getting this work done. Thank you.
And before we move on, the things, Rocky, that you said that you did to the bill, that was in the House, so that's in the version we have, or that's in contemplated?
What I described is what's in 3217A, so the engrossed version from the original introduced bill.
Great. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gordon Grant, and I'm a research hydrologist with the USDA Forest Service Pacific Northwest Research Station in Corvallis, Oregon. I'm also a courtesy professor of geosciences at Oregon State University. My testimony here is intended to provide context and technical background to the bill under consideration. My position as a federal scientist specifically prohibits me from advocating for or against any proposed legislation. The broader context that motivates this bill is the current state of streams and watersheds throughout eastern Oregon and, in fact, the American West. Many of the streams you see today in this region have undergone significant changes over the past century or more. Specifically, many of these streams are deeply cut down or incised gullies or arroyos bordered by wide valleys of sagebrush where once wet meadows prevailed, marshy meadows filled with wetland vegetation and grasses and shallow streams prevailed. We know this because of the record of old volcanic ash and ponded silts and muds now visible in the steep gully walls. And so sort of as a Exhibit A is a about a 20-foot incised stream near Izzy, Oregon. And what you see today is the modern floodplain down at the bottom. But we know that that was not the condition of the stream over much of the last, let's say, 10,000 years. because that white thing you see over on the left is Mazama ash. So over the last 10,000 years or so, this stream has been sort of merrily building itself up through silts and such. We believe a lot of this was due to beaver dams. The historical floodplain for that former channel was where you now see that sagebrush across the top there. And the channel has cut down probably at sometime in the last 50 to 100 years. The causes of these incised channels have been hotly debated since the incision began over a century ago. Cattle and sheep grazing, changes in the climate, human activities to ditch and drain meadows for agriculture, and widespread trapping and decimation of beaver populations have all been implicated, and the jury is still out as to what the dominant mechanisms were. But there is no doubt that loss of the beaver and the dams that ponded water, stored sediment, and built up the valley bottoms was a major factor in transforming these waterways. Because these channels have cut down 5, 15, or even 30 feet or more in places, the channels now flow at elevations far below their former floodplains, as you see in the photo, which have become terraces. Without deliberate, thoughtful, and fairly large-scale interventions that raise the water level back to the former floodplains, they cannot return to their previous levels and recover their function. A number of different strategies have been proposed and in places implemented to accomplish this, and again, the jury is still out as to the most effective approaches. And so if you want to see what this place may have looked like shortly prior to its incision, you can see some of the landscape is still unincised. You can see an abandoned beaver complex. The beaver is no longer maintaining it. And the valley has filled up with sediment and is covered with grasses. But this is prior to any cutting down. This just gives you a window back into time. One plausible and, in my view, particularly successful strategy has been to build so-called artificial beaver dams. Small, low-head weirs made of natural material of rock, wood, or some combination thereof. The purpose of these, quote, ABDs is several-fold. First, much like beaver dams, they impede the flow, creating a chain of ponds interspersed by small steps. If properly engineered, these ponds raise the water table back up to the level of the valley floor, killing the valley sagebrush and other dryland species, and making it possible for wet meadow vegetation and grasses to grow once again adjacent to the channel. This introduces both hydraulic and ecologic complexity and makes it possible for aquatic and riparian habitats for fish, beavers, and other species to become reestablished. Building these structures first is a necessary condition for reintroducing beavers into these areas. Without their preferred habitat, the beavers cannot build their dams by themselves and will not reoccupy these channels, even if deliberately reintroduced. But once the ABDs are in place, native species that are an essential part of beaver diets can become established, and the beavers will return and often occupy and maintain the ABDs as if they had built them in the first place. Here are some examples of some of these ABDs that have been engineered in eastern Oregon. And you can see in the upper right-hand panel that a beaver has actually occupied the structure and is happily maintaining it. But you get a sense then of the sort of low head stepping that is created by the structures themselves. Although the effects of building ABDs are striking and can dramatically change landscapes rather rapidly within 1 to 3 years, the full consequences of this restoration strategy are not well understood. To address this, a consortium of scientists representing a diverse set of scientific institutions, including the PNW Research Station and Oregon State University, have established the Cottonwood Creek Watershed Observatory in the Silvies River Valley. The purpose of this observatory is to evaluate the effects of ABDs and other restoration strategies on water supply, ecosystem function and health, and habitat for a wide range of organisms. Results of this research will be widely available to the public, other ranchers, land managers, and the regulatory community to help guide new approaches and strategies for restoring watersheds. And you can see, just to give you a sense of what implementing these ABDs does, this was a picture on the left was taken approximately 4 years before implementation. You can see the sagebrush meadow in a narrow incised stream in the middle. About 4 years afterwards, you see a rather dramatic increase in the amount of riparian vegetation. This is a series of ponds are sort of allowing the valley floor to be rewatered, and the ranchers actually growing grass once again on the valley bottom. From my perspective, the challenge of restoring eastern Oregon waterways and habitats can be achieved, but will require innovative strategies, collaboration, and experimentation. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I will not try to add too much to the much more smarter gentleman here on either side of me. Good afternoon, Chairman Edwards and members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. My name is Alan Hickenbottom. I'm here in place of Brent Fenty, who is the Executive Director of the Oregon Natural Debtors Association, where I sit on the board. Thank you for this opportunity to provide the comments for this pilot project, and I think the term pilot project is important because it gives us a chance to try some things and see what works. For this voluntary stream restoration and beaver recovery, quick thing on ONDA. It's a nonprofit public interest conservation organization of more than 4,500 members and supporters. We exist to protect, defend, and restore the health of Oregon's native deserts. We have a long history of monitoring ecological conditions and wilderness values throughout eastern Oregon, and we actively participate in watershed restoration decisions concerning land use management in eastern Oregon. This testimony in its detail is available to you. It was provided, I think, by Brent this afternoon to Ms. Riley. We've advocated for passive restoration in many areas of Oregon's high desert, but in this case, we think that this is a balanced and creative approach to try and fix a problem in areas where passive restoration, we think, well may not work. I did want to address one concern that was brought up, and just read that passage, that we are aware of their concerns have been raised by the Department of State Lands and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife regarding fish passage. As noted above, our hope is that restoration efforts made possible by this bill will recover beaver, fish, and other native species in streams where they are currently absent. In many cases, we will not be able to recover native fish and beaver populations without the participation of private landowners. To encourage landowner participation, we will need to ensure that recovering fish to streams does not create new liabilities for them who are successful, for landowners who are successful in restoring historic stream conditions. We would be happy to work with agencies and other stakeholders to determine whether changes in language would be appropriate for future assurances of passage in stream reaches as fish populations are restored. Alternatively, we look forward to working through such a process as part of future rulemaking efforts. So we strongly support scientifically credible evaluation of projects to ensure robust project design to inform future efforts with the best available information, collaboration among the landowners within the Malheur Lake Basin, conservation organizations, land managers, and other diverse stakeholders will continue to improve our common understanding of these ecosystems and inform how we can recover beaver to benefit ecological function and human needs. If I could divert from this just for a moment, I would say for myself, as a non-scientist and a non-lawyer, I do sit on the board of ONDA. I also sit on the board of the Oregon Business Association, which gets me odd looks once in a while. But I think this bill is a perfect example of what I think is important in the state, is looking for creative and balanced solutions to difficult problems. So we strongly support this bill and hope you do as well, and would certainly take any questions.
Great. Thank you each for your testimony. Questions for the panelists? Senator Denbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Last summer, I got to visit the Sylvie's Ranch with Chair Edwards, and I think we were able to see just some of the positive benefits of taking these steps to simulate beaver action. At the time, there was the beginning of a study was going to be done by Oregon State, I think, and my understanding is that that's underway now. And I don't know, you were involved with that, Gordon. I remember, and I can't remember if it was you or if it was Brent, you know, who said, was really pleased that this was underway, kind of wished that you'd been called in from day one so that you could really get a baseline, to see just what exactly how these changes were working. But one of the one of the things that I think is going to be studied is what is going to be the effect on downstream water rights holders. And I think, there was a concern that was expressed at the time about that. We don't have that information yet, do we? I mean, there's still some questions that I think that the OSU study is trying to find answers to, And so, you know, one question I have is, are we prematurely moving into a pilot project here, you know, for this one model when, you know, the study is still underway? And, you know, I wonder if you could address that. And then I have another question.
Yeah, sure.
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembrow, thank you. Yes, the Oregon State, it's a consortium study, Oregon State, and my graduate student, Caroline Nash, who's leading it, is here in the audience, and U.S. Forest Service and others are involved with this. The intent is to get answers to those fundamental questions. You know, what happens to the water, how much water, how does it change the water cycle, how much water is available downstream at what time of the year, and so forth. We anticipate, because of the way the study is proceeding, we will not have a direct measurement of the effects of putting in ABDs for some time, but we will have the data we need to make some at least first-order predictions about what the consequences might be, you know, if we ever get any more moisture in the state. The intent is to come in to a game that is already in progress, and I should emphasize that the game is a broadly played one. It is this kind of restoration strategies being implemented throughout the American West, the Sierras, in Washington, throughout the Great Basin, and so forth. So there, it's not all resting on our study, but we do have high expectations that this is going to help us answer some basic questions as we go.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. Just to follow up with that, so your sense is that we don't need to wait for that study to show more results before we, you know, open up the, you know, this particular methodology of the, you know, more hard-packed ABDs, as opposed to some of the softer things, you know, the things that look more like beaver dams in your photo. I wonder if you have a sense of that?
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembrow, I can't speak to, you know, whether you should or should not open things up. I can say that the nature of these interventions that are falling under the name of ABDs are consistent. These are not to be confused with natural beaver dams. I mean, there are some key differences that distinguish them. But in general, they do the same sort of thing as we would expect natural beaver dams to do. They retain water. They pond water. Water is allowed to does not drain from the surfaces of the valley bottoms in the same way that beaver meadows and so forth. So in that sense, I think that we're not introducing something that is absolutely foreign to this landscape. It certainly was a piece of the landscape for most of its time immemorial. But understanding the actual implications of doing any particular intervention, of course, rests on being able to measure it and so forth. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but it gives you, I mean, my sense is that we are in a position, or will be in a position within, let's say, you know, a year or so, to make first-order predictions about what the consequences would be in ways that we have not so far done.
Follow-up. And in terms of fish passage, right now that's not an issue. It's Sylvie's Ranch. The fish haven't really, you know, come back. But the hope is that they will. And then at that time, I think the legislation has some steps that, you know, can be required, will be required. Presumably the state will be required to pay for it, which is another question. But I guess the softer kinds of artificial beaver dams have the possibility for fish to get through there, right? As fish could historically were able to get through beaver dams, but it's much more difficult for them to get through the harder ones. Does it make sense at some point, you know, if, you know, as the water table's going up and maybe fish are, in fact, starting to come back, at that point to take them down and replace them with the more you know, the softer, more natural forms. Is that something that the study is going to look at?
Chair Edwards, Senator Denbrough, I'm pushed a little outside my comfort zone because I don't do fish directly, but I can tell you a little bit about my observation. While fish are not going to be swimming through some of these rock structures anytime soon, the way they're designed, at least I've seen them designed at Sylvie's, is that they're very low head structures. That is, they're designed specifically so that no structure ends up representing more than a couple, 6 inches, let's say, usually at the outside of drop for the channel. And that's intended to keep them in place. It's a safety feature as well, because you don't want a lot of erosion happening at any one structure. So they're a fairly dense array of these structures with low heads. And my impression is, in looking at some of these places where they have been in for, let's say, a decade, is that the fish have had no trouble getting through them, that they managed to get through the structures over the top of them through the outlets. And now, whether that's true in all cases, I can't say. But and true for all fishes, I can't say. But generally, I'm impressed by the places where these things have been implemented seem to have, even for people who don't study fish like me, clear evidence of resident fish populations. Thank you.
Other questions for the panel?
No.
Okay. Thank you each for your testimony. And before I call up the next panel, we're going to jump back to a work session on a previous bill that we heard. Mr. Chandler was up here for the public hearing on House Bill 3223. We're going to work that bill now before we start losing committee members. So I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 3223.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3223A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson has moved House Bill 3223A or 3223.
3223A.
Yeah, 3223A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. But is there any discussion? Okay, seeing no discussion, are there any objections? No objections, the motion carries. And let's see, Senator Olson, you want to carry this? Okay, Senator Olson, carry the bill, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 3223. And that clears the deck of everything that was pending, except finishing up this hearing. So I'm going to jump back to our ABD hearing, and I'm going to call up Bill Ryan and Brett Brownscombe and Ken. I'm not sure, Ken, what your last name is.
Boffin.
Okay. The three of you could come forward, and then on deck will be Brian Posewitz, Tom Wolf, and Jim Myron.
Okay, Chair Edwards and members of the committee, for the record, Brett Brownscombe, acting interim deputy director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I guess while we're waiting for Bill Ryan, I'll kick it off for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. First off is to say House Bill 3127, I think, has been covered as to what the bill would do. And to cut to the chase, I would not be here today to contest on behalf of the department the problem statement as it's been defined, or even the representation of the potential causes behind the problems. That's been well covered, and I think, as some of you on the committee have seen and others, there are concerns out there over current habitat conditions, and the department recognizes that, and I think it's a positive thing what's been spoken to so far, that there is a diverse coalition of people, everybody from environmental advocacy groups to private landowners and the science community and the business community, who want to get together and figure out a way to creatively and in a balanced way solve some problems. And that's positive, and we are glad it's happening and want to be a part of that. This is not the first time that there's been a proposed human intervention to address a quote-unquote problem that has also been caused through previous human interventions. And so there's been a history of this kind of a proposal to do something that involves active human management to address a previous active human action on the land. This reminds of the 1964 floods, and I was far from alive then, but there is an ongoing legacy of projects and effects from projects that were done to essentially address what happened in 1964 with the floods, and a series of efforts were done to move water off the land faster to prevent future flooding, or to and a lot of that involves straightening channels or putting riprap in to prevent further migration of water outside of channels, and even use of dynamite in some channels to straighten them. Those interventions have created a long, and I think other agencies, including OWEB, may be better ones to testify on this, but a long history of use of state, federal, and other dollars to address consequences or unintended consequences of those problems. And so the testimony that I wanted to focus on and then hand it over to Ken Lawfink is that our concerns over this approach are not based on whether to do active management or whether there's a problem or whether a pilot approach should even happen. I think all of those things we would answer in the affirmative. The concerns that OWEB has over the proposed bill as written are what methods will be taken to address the problem. It's kind of a crudely stated, not whether to get a haircut, but what kind of tools we're going to use and what kind of style we're going to come out with, and or maybe better put, not whether to do an intervention on a to address a problem, but the tools and methods we're going to use to do it, and what are the outcomes we can expect from it. So our testimony here is largely based on experience with a variety of different projects that already exist on the land. And Ken Lawfink's testimony will cover that. Ken is our assistant. Ken, I'm gonna butcher this. Assistant Fish Passage
Just
Coordinator.
Just promote him.
He'll introduce himself.
On the record.
Ken is our fish guy.
I'm working
guy.
For you, Ken.
Right on. And I'll turn it over to Ken in a second. I want to get to a few things, though. So just to highlight for the committee, the concerns here are based on the experience to date, but also the opportunities are based on experience to date. There's a variety of actions that have been taken on the ground right now where one could say we already have a pilot or a series of pilots in motion. And I think some of that was alluded to in previous testimony related to the Cottonwood Creek Observatory and other work that's happening. We have approaches that we can continue to monitor and test. It's not as if, and I think this was stated up front, this bill is needed in order to start getting to work on something. There's already work that's happened and that we can monitor. To the extent the legislature wants to continue to work on the defined problem here and introduce a new pilot that gets at exemptions from fish passage statutes as well as general authorizations under Department of State Lands authorities, all we're saying as a department is let's do it, let's go down that path if we're going to go down that path. In a way that more closely mimics true beaver dams, including their elevation, their materials, and their function. This can be done in a way that minimizes risks. We think inherent in a pilot approach is there's something that is still out there that needs to be learned before something else is exported and replicated across whatever landscape and whatever, you know, pilot area or broader context we're talking about beyond a pilot area. So within the pilot concept is this assumption of we don't entirely know what the outcomes are going to be, so let's do and be active in managing but learn while we're doing it while minimizing the risks while we go along. So some of this is an issue over how artificial beaver dams are defined in the bill and concerns related to that. Other concerns relate to whether the exemption or what qualifies as a qualifying stream under this bill is limited to just areas outside of current migratory fish habitat or also areas that are historic fish habitat. From the department's perspective, streams are not siloed. A lot of what has happened over history and could happen in the future may make what is now not functioning as fish habitat future habitat, and we would like to see restoration efforts that do that. We'd also like to make sure that once fish are given a chance to get back to a certain area, that they not face obstacles that will then require significant inputs of money, time, and further restoration efforts to address a future passage problem. So right now, the bill would require an approach to dealing, if practicable, with future fish migration issues. We would prefer to see that anticipated in advance and designed in advance into how these projects are constructed so that, like a true beaver dam, there is an ability for fish to pass in the future and the structures won't have the kind of permanence and hard walling that may require future expenditures of state and other monies to fix them. We think this can be done, and it has been done in a series of cases, and I'll turn it over to Ken to talk through some of those in a way that is pragmatic and low cost to the landowner, and that's also not going to undercut the effectiveness of these projects in achieving the objectives here of raising the water table, reconnecting floodplains, and achieving wet meadow habitat and future beaver habitat recovery. So, again, thank you for the opportunity to testify, and we do support the restoration motivations of this bill and what underlies that. It's, I think, the concerns that we're hoping to work through with you and with bill proponents relate to the means we take to get to achieving those objectives. So thank you again. And Ken Loffink is...
Thanks, Brett. For the record, Chair Edwards, Senators, my name is Ken Loffink. I'm the Assistant Fish Passage Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Maybe a role to be named later. Kidding. In my role with ODFW, I deal with anything and everything to do with fish passage across the state, you know, from, you know, culvert projects or reviewing and approving fish passage projects like fish ladders or reviewing restoration type projects and ensuring that they meet our current fish passage criteria. I'll echo what Brett said and say that, you know, we're definitely in favor of restoration and that beaver dams in themselves are important to native fish habitat. They provide vital habitat for fish. They form complex channels. They provide for fish passage and promote natural processes to occur. The questions we have lie in the description or the definition of ABDs as well as qualifying streams in House Bill 3217. Prospective ABDs, excuse me, built under this pilot may not provide those same functions that a natural beaver dam would occur. And I have just a really brief slideshow that gets at some of the things I'm discussing. I also mentioned that, you know, we all know there's lots of money and time and effort's been put into restoration science over the last, you know, many decades. That science is still evolving. There's a lot of new things out there that we're all trying to grasp. But one type of restoration action that's currently going on is to try to mimic what's going on with beaver dams and trying to mimic those. Oh boy. Now we did it. Okay, I won't touch anything. So this is a quick web search on beaver dam. It's called the Beaver Dam Analog. It's actually over in the John Day Basin. Quick Google search will come up with a variety of papers and projects that have sought out to mimic, you know, what a natural beaver dam does on the landscape. This is a really simple one of just literally placing poles. A lot of it's, you know, usually untreated alder or something like that. We call them beaver stakes. Pound them into the stream bed across the channel. They really form the basis of something a beaver could build a dam on. They also collect large wood as it flows downstream. Next slide shows some of these. You can see the poles or the stakes, if you will, they're in the foreground. You can see it's accumulated a lot of debris, a lot of large wood. It's pulling up habitat. We're pulling up water, excuse me. We're storing sediment behind there. You're also starting to see some of the natural processes that occur. On the right side of the screen there, you see a side channel beginning to form. That's something that something like a juvenile fish could swim up rather easy. You also have a lot of interstitial flow going through the structure. It's wood. It's very porous. So you have flow going down the center. In some cases, that can provide for fish passage as well. You have flow going over the top of the structure as well. It's creating this dynamic, complex channel that our aquatic organisms and native fish like. This is also an example during high flows, same basin. I'll first call the note just the very incised nature of this channel. You can see the bank in the top. There's no question that this is an issue in some of our eastern Oregon streams. You know, this project was put in place to try to address that and slowly, improve interaction with the floodplain, improve those processes. You know, the structures themselves you can see within the stream. The middle one there is fully intact. It's forcing flow out in the floodplain. You got flow coming around. You can see the lower right-hand corner there. I mean, that's something an adult fish. This is actually within anadromy, so it's in the John Day Basin, so a salmon could swim up there. I go to the Great Basin, you know, adult spawning red band could swim up there, provide fish passage around these structures. Then the lower one, I can see during high flows, it's blown out. Now, that process is important. You know, beaver dams are meant to be transient on the landscape. You know, they're seasonal. They blow out at various times. They store sediment, and then when they blow out, you know, that sediment moves downstream, which is important for stream habitat and function. So that's just an example of something creating really good complex habitat we like to see. It's also doing some of those processes for restoration that we want to see as well. This is kind of an intermediary between the soft approach where we're just pounding in stakes to a little harder approach. This is something called a roughened channel. It just generically means an oversteepened, designed section of stream that is used to check something up. That we use them a lot in for dam removal projects where we have to maintain a certain water surface elevation for any given reason. You know, in this case, there's a lake level. It could be a diversion upstream, something like that. Something we need a hardened surface to stay there. Well, there's methods where we can provide for fish passage. We can provide those habitat complexities. We can provide for improved sediment transport with this type of structure. It takes time. Takes a careful design. It's not easy to do, but it's certainly something that's possible and is currently meets current fish passage standards and was within our current policy. So here's a couple examples of ABDs that are on the landscape now. You know, again, with the description in House Bill 3217 is for 2 feet above the historic floodplain, which in some cases, as we talked about, can be quite high. So these, you know, there's some scale. There's some people in the foreground. I mean, these structures themselves are 8 to 10 feet high. You know, those boulders are 4 feet tall. Those aren't going anywhere. So some of the very important concepts or processes that occur, you know, from seasonal blowouts, things like that, sediment transport, large wood going downstream, isn't going to happen with these types of structures. They're going to be on the landscape for a long time, and maybe longer than I'm going to be around as well as all of us. So yeah, that seasonal nature is gone. You know, with this type of structure, it acts essentially like a dam. You know, for dam removal projects, which we do all the time, you know, one of the biggest advantages of performing a dam removal project is restoring that that sediment transport, that natural fluvial processes that occur that don't occur when you have a permanent hard structure blocking the stream channel. A couple of other examples here you can see. These are lower head, still creating some discontinuity. This is actually during the spring. You can see, you know, there's some relics of when these channels were built, you know, flooded out vegetation, things like that. But stuff like that's not going to move downstream and could end up starving downstream habitats. You know, something that could actually lead to further channel erosion in the future downstream from holding up sediments higher up in the watershed. You also see these are wide, they're flat, they're being used as road stream crossings, not necessarily providing some of the same benefits that a natural beaver dam would. Again, same sort of thing. We have disconnected pools. This is during low flows. At higher flows, we'll get water flowing to the top of this, and if designed correctly, could provide for fish passage. But the concern is, in the bill, it doesn't necessarily call for that. And I'll just conclude with, you know, we have current restoration practices that are consistent with fish passage criteria. With the use of those structures, if whether fish are there or not, if they do show up, they're going to provide for fish passes. They're consistent with state policy, and would require no other action in the future from landowners or the state. Whereas, you know, some of these structures, you know, retrofitting this for fish passes could be quite costly and quite a big disturbance to the stream. So there's some concerns there. With that, I'll entertain any questions.
Move on to Bill, and then we'll open up to questions.
Thank you, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bill Ryan, Assistant Director of the Department of State Lands. And I'd like to reiterate what previous two folks have said, that it really is in our interest to encourage restoration of natural hydrology and natural processes in watersheds in eastern Oregon and throughout Oregon for that matter. And the department is the state agency responsible for the conservation of waterways and wetlands in the state, is very interested in doing that. The department's primary concern is the ability to actually develop a general permit or a streamlined permit that would allow the types of structures that actually you see in Ken's, the later part of Ken's presentation, these very large, hard structures that are spanning completely to the channel and expanding up into the floodplain. The general authorizations and general permits that are mentioned in the bill are really streamlined programmatic approaches, meaning a lot of the analysis is done up front in terms of what the effects are or what the potential outcomes will be of doing these particular activities. And they're really intended to be done for basically routine, frequent kinds of activities or projects, things that happen all the time. We have general permit for different types of roadway construction and maintenance. You know, we've got a really long track record of culvert replacements and that sort of thing, and we know kind of what the conditions will be, what the expectations will be, and what the outcomes will be after doing those types of activities. My concern is that for these large structures that we wouldn't be able to develop a general permit that would meet the criteria for a general permit that we have per statute. And the criterion, the one that will be most challenging to meet, is to be able to make a finding that there would be no unacceptable environmental effects either individually or cumulatively for these projects. So that means, you know, a single project or many projects in a given watershed, and also making a similar finding that there's no long-term harm to water resources of the state. And I think that for these types of structures, at least from the information that I've seen, that it's a little premature for us to be able to actually make that determination without a track record of success or long-term studies, that sort of thing. So that's the primary concern. The other thing that I would like to add is that, you know, when we do programmatic approaches to restoration projects, we really are looking at trying to establish a condition on the ground that actually mimics a natural condition. And in a natural beaver complex, they actually evolve pretty significantly over time. The beavers abandon different structures get blown out, and you end up over time with a mix of different age ponds or meadows. Ponds actually will evolve into meadows when the dam no longer holds water, and so you end up with a very complex structure there that acts quite differently than what I anticipate this kind of a situation would look like in the long term, where you have multiple large hard structures close to each other moving up a watershed. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you each. Questions for the panel?
I have a question for you, Bill. So the way the bill is drafted, the general authorization is for the entire basin, as I understand it, but I mean, would an individual landowner, I can see that the desire is to not to have to come in and get a permit for each, you know, different dam that's put in, but would a landowner be required, you know, each individual landowner to come in with a plan for what she or he is doing on their property, or and what the effects would be downstream, or how do you see this playing out? I realize a lot would be through rulemaking, but...
Right. Yeah. Chair Edwards, Senator Denbrough, it depends upon what type of programmatic permit that you're going for. Both the general authorization or general permit are done through rulemaking if they're open to any applicants. We can develop a general permit for a specific applicant or groups of applicants, basically being able to name who the entities are that will be using that. But I envision this would be more of an open thing, so any private owner could use it. And so, yes, so for a general authorization, it's actually a pre-approval. The department will have done an analysis based upon the conditions that you have to meet, you know, size criteria, location criteria, that sort of thing. And if you meet these criteria, then you basically are already authorized. And so there isn't an individual review, like a public review, of that specific notification. In fact, they are notice-based. General authorizations are notice-based. So you're only required to tell the department that you're planning on doing this activity. The department will then look at that application and make a determination quickly, yes, do we think it fits, or no, we think you need a different kind of permit to do this. For a general permit, we do have more flexibility in terms of what the review looks like, and we would certainly require some sort of analysis of what the hydrology of the location is. Are there fish present or not? Is there historic fish presence? What will be the effects of that structure, et cetera? But there is a shortened review both by the public and by natural resource, you know, regulatory agencies for that type of permit.
Follow up. And so if I'm a downstream water right holder and I had a concern about, you know, the project that my upstream neighbor was contemplating, what would be my ability to intervene there?
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembro. So the first piece would be during the actual development of the general permit or general authorization through rulemaking. So that does have a public noticing saying we're developing these rules. Here's what the proposed rule looks like, the ability to comment, that sort of thing. Then later down the road, for a general permit, we would have most likely built in some sort of a notification, like a 2-week notification, something like that, a review period, and so someone could come in and actually challenge the permit decision and actually contest it, and so use a contested case procedure if they were not able to, through the normal comment and response process, attain satisfaction.
Well, I don't think that I have any other questions. Thank you each for being here and your testimony and getting your concerns out there. Next, we are going to call up Brian Posowitz, Tom Wolf, and Jim Myron.
Chair Edwards, committee member. For the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the Executive Director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, here to testify on HB 3217. We already have our comments in on O-List that we will. Here's the thing. I grew up, was born in Eastern Oregon. I certainly understand the concerns of many people out there in the high desert area, although and also I have a background in fish and wildlife science from Oregon State, so frankly artificial beaver dams gives me the heebie-jeebies. So having said that, this is a very sincere effort by the landowner to do something to restore the function of this stream in this area. So after having long conversations with the scientific staff of Trout Unlimited and looking at some proposed amendments that have been suggested that are on O-List about what the previous panel just said, Trout Unlimited would not oppose this bill if the issues about fish passage were addressed. Now, the high desert area where there's native red band and other species was a system historically that during the winter they could have high cold water, during the summer, they could have temperatures in the 80s, and the red band trout were adapted to that. But one of the reasons they were able to adapt that was the ability to travel up and down the stream system as needed be, to have fish passage so they can move up and down to areas they could get the best needs met. And without proper fish passage on these proposed artificial beaver dams, and I think that we have some concerns. So we feel that there needs to be a fish passage addressed in these structures. We certainly applaud what the landowner and others have done on this land. It's you know, I always applaud efforts to do the right thing, but we have to think that when the fish do come back and they do reestablish it, they need to have proper ability to move up and down the system. So we urge that these amendments and these concerns of DSL and ODFW be met, and if they are, Trout Unlimited has no opposition to this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Jim Meyer, and I'm here representing the Native Fish Society. And just to be brief, we opposed this bill as it came out of the House. We continue to oppose it because of the two issues that you've heard a lot about today, the fish passage issue and the permitting issue on the fill and removal laws. So we understand that there are some bills drafted or some amendments drafted that may address those. And if those two issues are adequately addressed, we will no longer oppose the bill. Thank you.
Thank you both.
Chair Edwards and members of the committee, my name is Brian Posowitz. I'm here on behalf of Water Watch of Oregon, and I prepared some PowerPoint slides mostly to show you some pictures. There were actually, I don't recall anybody showing pictures on the House side, and I thought it would be helpful, but it looks like everybody else has beaten me to it, but I may have a couple of new ones.
This is
here
the
anyway.
Senate.
We
need pictures.
Yeah, okay. All right. And
simple pictures without many words.
Yeah, well, and that gets me to my next point, which is I couldn't resist the temptation to dump some detailed information into a couple of these slides, but I know my time's limited, and I'm just going to blow over some of these. Okay. Unless you want me to stop in any of them, just tell me. But my presentation is on all this, so if you want to see any of the Perfect. Supporting detail to a couple of my points, you can look at that.
Yeah, I hit the high points, particularly if anything hasn't been hit, and then we will we'll stop in if we have questions,
and
we'll go deeper.
And I'll very much try to do that. So Water Watch is a nonprofit conservation organization dedicated to protecting and restoring natural flows in Oregon's rivers, and the organization this year celebrates its 30th anniversary. We oppose House Bill 3217 in its current form. In general, we think it's premature to extend this. First of all, we do support innovative approaches to watershed restoration, and we think that this technique of artificial beaver dams deserves further study. That said, we think it's premature to extend this broad concept in terms of everything it can encompass to such a big geographic area, which is actually turns out to be about 10% of the state, without requiring normal permit reviews, given the state of study that's being done at existing sites. We also think that the bill requires additional safeguards to protect against risk of damage to natural resources, and most significantly, the bill would allow new dams to be put in streams with historic fish presence without requiring fish passage. Just in terms of what the basis for my testimony and my opinions about this at this point, I've put a lot of work into this, and the highlight I would say is I did go to Sylvie's Valley Ranch, and Scott Campbell, the owner, spent a whole day with me, and I learned a lot, and I was very grateful for his hospitality and the time he gave me. Artificial beaver dams can. The part of the problem here is that artificial beaver dams can mean a lot of different things, and the statutory term, the statute defines it very broadly. It could mean structures like these. These are on Pine Creek in the John Day watershed, and as you can see, they're very low impact structures, and it's one structure. It's a very low impact structure, and there's clearly a way for the fish to get by it.
It also includes structures like these, which are on the Silvies Valley Ranch. And when you look at this, I think it's important to think about the bill would say you can do this without a specific DSL review, without requiring fish passage, and with an assumption that they're not required to have a water right. Most people agree that real beaver dams are good for streams, and I think the literature says that fish can pass them either upstream or downstream. I've talked with the folks at ONDA, too. You heard their testimony, and they tell me that they actually have, as I understand it, tags in the fish and receivers in the stream, and they can document fish moving past where the real beaver have taken over. There are also these things called beaver dam support structures, and the evidence is that real beavers will use those and build real beaver dams. As for these large artificial beaver dams, that are, some of which you see on the Silvies Valley Ranch, these hard structures, I think that it's fair to say that the effects are not well established. And Gordon Grant, in his testimony, was the same on the House side. He said the full consequences of this restoration strategy are not well understood. And similarly, there's a presentation online from Ms. Nash. I believe she's here as well, where she said one of the things they're studying there that still have to be studied are the hydrologic, geomorphic, and ecological impacts of these things. So my point is just that we don't really know how these big, hard structure things are going to work. What's the potential harm? Number one, we could eliminate fish passage on historic fish streams, which would defeat a key restoration goal. Number two, they have a potential to increase water temperature both behind the dams and downstream, and that's an issue acknowledged in the ONDA testimony. Three, they can alter the flow downstream, which is could be bad for fish as well as downstream water rights. And it's important to remember in that context that fish don't need just the low flows, that the high flows, that all the scientists these days will say those high flows can be very important to fish habitat too. It's not just about minimum flows in dry months. So what should be done? Our view is we should wait for these studies to play out that are already underway at the existing structures. And these are the project partners, so there's a fair number of folks looking at this. And these are pictures of the Cottonwood Creek Watershed Observatory. And just to give you a sense of what's going on there, that picture on the left is a weir to measure precisely the flow coming in, and I believe there's a similar weir at the bottom and on the tributary. So they're going to precisely measure the flow, and this is just sort of the creek floodplain where they're going to put these artificial beaver dams. And when I was there, they were sort of still being constructed, and they'll extend, you know, I as it was explained to me, about two-thirds of the way across there. And this is another study site, Payne Creek, and you can see they've got the sign up with a lot of different people studying these structures. If we don't wait, our Water Watch believes there should be further direction given to DSL for its rulemaking. That direction should include to provide for fish passage on historic fish streams, to limit the size of these dams, even if only to say they need to look like real beaver dams, to limit incompatible land uses such as continuous grazing. And Mr. Campbell would tell you, I believe, he told me, that he believes that if you do these restoration efforts, you need to limit how much grazing occurs in the riparian area. He doesn't believe they should be off entirely, but I think he would tell you they should be limited to a couple of weeks, a couple of times a year. We think there should also be some direction to prevent unintended uses of these dams, such as using them just to facilitate an irrigation diversion in an approach called, often referred to, something called a push-up dam is typically used to do that. But if they're supposed to be a restoration tool, we think they shouldn't be used just to divert water into an irrigation ditch, and there should be some direction in the bill for that. There should be some revegetation requirement and something to ensure the dams aren't permanent, because most of the people studying this will say they should be in permanent-type structures. And we think there should be something to say, if it turns out they don't work, that they cause more harm than good, there should be something that says they should be taken out, and that's not in the bill. So in conclusion, we think this bill should wait until some of this study is further along. If not, we think the bill should be amended. We, too, understand that there are some amendments being proposed from the state agencies that would address what we see as the biggest concerns, which is the lack of fish passage and the overall scale of these. Although we think those amendments aren't perfect, we would not oppose the bill if they were added. And with that, I'd be thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, good job of getting through a lot of information there.
Well, thank you. I hope I didn't talk too fast. Yeah.
No, and I think I understood it all.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Which is
that's scary.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
More kudos to you. Questions?
Just following up on Tom and Brian's testimony, you know, as I said at the beginning, I was very impressed with what I saw out there at Sylvie's Ranch. I mean, you know, some of the grasslands that's come back and, you know, the way that Scott Campbell is trying to build a business model, you know, with the cattle and the goats and all that. And, you know, for me, as, you know, someone very ignorant about this subject area, it really was an eye-opener. And just reminding me, you know, what should be evident to all of us, and that is, you know, the important role that the beaver played in this landscape and the almost irreparable harm that was created when they were taken out. So, you know, I love the efforts that underlie this. And, you know, so the challenge will be how to do it and do it right. So, you know, I just wanted to put that on the record. I appreciated your statements along those lines.
Thank you. Brian, you said, I was typing some notes here while you were talking, one of your concerns was about water rights and the ability of somebody to be able to put a dam in place whether or not they have a water right. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, no, I didn't mean to say that. So the bill does have some language now, which we requested and it was added, that says nothing in this bill, the way it's worded, nothing in this bill modifies the Water Rights Act as defined in such and such. So it basically says this bill isn't overriding the requirements for a water appropriation permit. And so if you do something that would otherwise require such a permit, our understanding is that you still need to go get a water appropriation permit. My point was just that it's a hard line to draw, you know, to when are you backing up water to the extent that you do need a permit. And so my point was just kind of when we look at these, at some of these bigger structures, just keep in mind that we're saying they don't need a DSL permit, or they don't need a specific DSL permit. They don't have to provide fish passage, and there's kind of an assumption that these ABDs don't require a water right permit. So I was just sort of saying that in context for how to evaluate the images. But I hope I've answered your questions.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
I don't have any other questions. I guess I'll just is there anybody else that wanted to testify on this? Raise your hand if you wanted to. Okay, I don't see anybody else. I don't have any other questions. I guess I'd like to echo the sentiments of Senator Denbrough. To me, these are the type of things we need to try to figure out. You have some landscapes that have been so altered over time, and this is one of those efforts to try and find a way, you know, with an intervention to both improve the environment and improve the economic viability of the landscape. And I think trying to achieve perfection in either arena is just going to be impractical. And so 30 years from now, we'll still be talking about, well, if we only would have done this, or maybe looking forward, we could do this. I understand a lot of the concerns you have, and I share some of the concerns. So I hope that we can reach an area that meets some of those concerns. I'm not quite on board with the idea that we should just continue to study, you know, this one little piece of land. I don't know, maybe little isn't
pretty big.
Maybe that's not a fair characterization. I caught myself. But you know, this one region and the artificial beaver dams are on that specific ranch and preclude us from moving forward on anything. But I hear you, what you're saying about some of the concerns, and I've written a bunch of them down here, and I think that we should be able to get to a place where we can all support this bill. If you could speak to, and I don't know if anybody left in from the agent, any appropriate agencies are here that know about this, but costs are going to be important. So obviously, you know, if we raise the permitting, if the permitting threshold and the cost threshold is so high, then why would a rancher, a rancher's going to say, yeah, that's too much effort, I'm just not going to do it. And so you've got, you know, 100% policy goal, but it's 100% of zero. Mm-hmm. And that gets us nowhere. So trying to find that sweet spot, I think, where we can say, okay, there are appropriate thresholds in place. There are appropriate, paths forward. I have some of the same concerns that if fish return to a stream where they were not previous, then are there going to be significant public costs to removing some of these beaver dams if they're constructed in such a way that where they really are permanent structures. I also understand that it could be less expensive, significantly less expensive, for a rancher to go out there with a D8 and a backhoe and create an artificial beaver dam that way, rather than driving poles in the stream or whatever. I mean, I'm not sure, so I don't know what the costs of one versus the other are. But we just need to keep that regulatory barriers and costs in mind as we move forward. Otherwise, we're not going to have any of these, and I think we all lose if we can't move forward in some way. But I hear what you've had to say, and we're taking it to heart and trying to come up with some thoughtful amendments. So, yeah, Jim.
And just one quick response, Jim Myron again. Keep in mind that what has caused these problems with this incised channels is 125, 150 years of season-long grazing, and then flash floods come through and there's nothing there to hold the soil. So if we don't address in the long term some of the grazing practices, we're not going to get anywhere in the long term. Also, if a guy takes his D8 cat out there and starts making some of these dams, that's illegal right now. And without, you can't do that without a permit. So and that's what we're trying to figure out. What is the solution here? Maybe there do need to be some changes to the status quo to make it a little easier for landowners to do some of these things. But in my opinion, they're going to have to make a commitment as well to changes in certain practices that have been detrimental over the years.
Chair Edwards, may I respond briefly to that?
Yeah, please.
As well, Brian Posowitz again. So I just want to say I get very much the concept that if we proceed with this, we have to provide a low-cost, low-headache way for a landowner to do these things. And I do think there are some ways that our concerns can be addressed without defeating that goal. And just one thing I will say about the tour at the ranch and seeing some of these, most of them, not all of them, but most of them, they do over time, as it was said earlier, they tend to sort of erode and wear routes where, at least to a layman, it seems fish could pass. And so part of the issue, I think, is, how do we make it clear in the bill that these other ones that get built do that too,
Right. So. Okay. Thank you each for being here and your testimony. I'm going to call forward one more person because I think we're touching on some relevant issues. Raquel Rancier from the Water Resources Department, if you could provide some perspective on exchanges about the complexities of water law, which you may have heard us touching on, and you're probably thinking, they got it all wrong.
Chair Edwards.
Clarify some things, I imagine.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, Raquel Rancier, Senior Policy Coordinator with the Oregon Water Resources Department. I just wanted to provide a little bit of clarity on when a water right is required. If there is intent to beneficially use that water, for example, to use it for irrigation, the department will require a water right. Our interpretation of this bill is that it does not change anything in the water rights statutes, and in fact, it explicitly makes that clear. And so if we were to determine that a water right is required, this does nothing to change that. If you look at the testimony that we had submitted to the House, we did provide that as clarification as well, that in some instances a water right may be required, in some instances a water right might not be required based on whether or not they're intending to put that water to beneficial use.
So beneficial use, I mean, creating a floodplain that increases grass growth so that one could graze livestock or goats or whatever, I mean, is that a beneficial use?
Chair Edwards, that's an excellent question, and I'd have to get back to you on that.
Okay. If you could, I'd appreciate that. I mean, I was Absolutely. Sitting here thinking yeah. about that during yeah. the, like, okay, if you're backing up the water and creating a floodplain versus sticking a pump in the stream and running it through a sprinkler out on, I mean, it may, in effect, you know, create a very similar, maybe a very similar use, but different techniques. And I'm just wondering, does one trigger a water right, the necessity for a water right, and one doesn't? So.
Chair Edwards, I'd be happy to get back to you on that.
Thank you. Yes. Any other questions? Mm-hmm. All right. Anybody else like to testify on this bill? I don't see anybody, so we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3217A, and we are adjourned. We are adjourned.